You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 18th of March 2013 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One in London with me, Tom Edwards. Coming up in the next 60 minutes, Cypriots are fuming after being told they'll pay a levy on any savings they hold. But why are the Russians up in arms? 2 years since the deadly conflict in Syria began, opposition leaders are finally meeting to choose an interim prime minister. But who will they select? We'll head to Brazil to talk Fashion Week, and we'll see who's walked away with the architecture world's top prize.
Pritzker Prize is a way of opening up the architecture industry to the rest of the world. And architecture is quite a closed industry that doesn't necessarily get a huge amount of recognition from sort of everyday Joe public. But most people have heard of the Pritzker Prize. And so it's sort of welcoming someone into that hall of fame.
And to mark the imminent April issue of Monocle magazine, we head to Israel to find out if the mayor of Be'er Sheva can turn his desert town into an urban oasis.
He has some visions in his mind, visions about desert and very old and dusty buildings. I'm here to change those visions, to tell a new story.
All that, plus we play some great music too, all to come in the next hour here on Midori House. Plenty to come then in the next 60 minutes. Before all that, let's catch up on the latest international news headlines.
Monocle 24 News, I'm Paul Osborne. Cyprus has been told it can vary the terms of a bank bailout after public protests and queues at cash machines. The 10 billion euro deal comes with a unique condition, a one-off levy on all Cypriot bank accounts. Banks in Cyprus will remain closed until Thursday as discussions continue. Many Russian businesses have large deposits in Cyprus, and the Russian President Vladimir Putin has called the levy unfair, unprofessional, and dangerous. The French Finance Minister Pierre Moscovici says there may be some room for manoeuvre.
Should it be all or only the people with a deposit above 100,000 euros? Let's wait now for the Cypriot government to say what is his wish. If his wish is to spare the depositors with low account, well, I'm ready to listen to that.
A man wanted over war crimes in the Democratic Republic of Congo has reportedly handed himself into the U.S. Embassy in Kigali. Officials in Rwanda say Bosco Ntaganda surrendered to American authorities on Sunday. He's accused of conscripting child soldiers, ethnic persecution and rape in eastern Congo. Syria's main opposition groups have been meeting in Istanbul to discuss the formation of a provisional government. It would be on standby in case the Assad regime falls, but could also take over the running of rebel-held areas. 12 candidates have emerged for the job of interim prime minister. One is Salem Al-Muslet.
It's important to be close to them, to be among them, to look at their problems and solve their problems and listen to them. I don't believe that a real government can operate from, for example, you know, outside any other country, but the real government that operates among the Syrian people. The Syrian people need leadership.
The jailed leader of the Kurdish rebel PKK movement is reportedly to call for a ceasefire. Abdullah Öcalan has said he'll make an historic announcement on Thursday. It follows a meeting with Kurdish politicians. In almost 30 years of fighting Turkey, more than 40,000 people have died. Argentina's president has met the new pope and asked him to intervene in her dispute with Britain over the Falkland Islands. Cristina Fernandez de Kirchner asked Pope Francis to promote dialogue. He has previously said that the Falklands belong to Argentina, despite being a British overseas territory. Airbus has won a record order for 234 planes. The Indonesian carrier Lion Air is buying them in a deal worth $24 billion. Lion only began operations 13 years ago. Although it has a dominant position in the Indonesian market, it's currently banned from flying inside the European Union or United States because of concerns about its safety standards. EasyJet, meanwhile, has become the first low-cost airline to fly to Moscow. tickets from London's Gatwick Airport cost between $100 and $600. These passengers were on the first flight.
Very excited. My first time as well. And I think it opens up Russia for all the British tourists and businessmen.
Amazingly easy to have a flight to Moscow because it gives us as consumers another choice.
Service was excellent, yeah, and they served vodka as well.
That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much indeed, Paul. It's 18.05 here in London. You're with Midori House on Monocle 24. Crisis in Cyprus. That's how some are referring to that country's shock decision to impose a levy on any savings held in Cypriot banks. The one-time tax is part of a $13 billion bailout by the EU and the IMF, and under the current terms would see people with deposits of up to €100,000 pay 6.75%. Anyone with over €100,000 in savings would pay almost 10% in their levy. Cypriots, as are perhaps understandable, furious at the plan that effectively penalises anyone who's put aside some money for a rainy day. But Russians are enraged as well. The country's president, as we were hearing in the news, Vladimir Putin, called the proposal unfair, unprofessional and dangerous. The reason? Russians love to deposit money in Cyprus. Estimates place up to $31 billion of Russian money in the country. If Russians are made to pay the levy, they could lose billions. Well, joining us now to get the Russian angle is David Herznorn, New York Times journalist in Moscow. David, thanks very much for joining us on Midori House, as always. I just wondered, how would you characterise then the reaction in Russia? We've obviously heard from the president, he's not happy. What about your sort of average man in the street?
There's no question there's a great deal of unease about this, not just President Putin, but Prime Minister Dmitry Medvedev has said this feels like old-style Soviet property seizure. You know, this rubs modern Russians the wrong way when they hear about the government coming in and grabbing hold of people's assets in this kind of way. And as you mentioned, the amount of deposits that Russians and Russian corporations have in Cyprus is just enormous. And there are also huge numbers of loans that have been made from banks to Cypriot-based Russian companies. Those may total somewhere between $30 and $40 billion. It's really quite a lot of money that's at stake.
Now, you mentioned it's at stake. I mean, what will we see here, do you think? Is there the prospect of Russia attempting to renegotiate loans, both in terms of these business loans and any kind of state money that's been provided? Do they have that kind of facility? Will there be the desire to see that kind of action, do you think?
There certainly may be. It's very interesting. Russia has already had a role in helping Cyprus in efforts to stabilize the country's finances. And in fact, there was a meeting planned for today between the Cypriot finance minister, Michaelis Saris, who was supposed to be in Moscow to talk to Russian officials. And that meeting may have, in fact, prompted the EU to move more quickly on this plan, worried that perhaps Russia would have an added bit of leverage in the future of the finances of Cyprus.
Now, talk to me a bit about what some of these companies, the Russian companies that are involved in Cyprus, are sort of attempting to get out of it. I gather that Gazprom, another real titan, is also involved or getting more involved. How do you characterize their role in the country? What's the dynamic really between these big businesses?
When you ask around in Moscow, people will tell you every big company, and usually those are oil and gas companies, has offices in Cyprus. TNK-BP, which has been the partnership with British Petroleum, Lukoil, and of course Gazprom, the huge behemoth state-owned natural gas company. And there has been rumors for quite some time that Gazprom and one of its subsidiaries, Gazprom Bank, has been involved in discussions, perhaps even to take over one of the big failing banks in Cyprus. That would obviously go a long way toward easing the cash crunch there and change the terms of whatever deal the Europeans came up with to bail out Cyprus. So that's just one of the ways that Gazprom could have been involved with one of its subsidiaries as a bank, either extending credit or even taking over one of the troubled banks in Cyprus.
So, and just remind us, I mean, obviously the background to this, there's so much of this Russian money, as we've discussed. Is it just because it's an easy, relatively unregulated market? It suits everyone for the money to flow in and out in this way? Or is there something else afoot? Is there some kind of trust that you think the Russians have perhaps built up over time with Cyprus as a place to kind of store these funds?
Well, it's a little bit of both. I was just speaking to my colleague Andrew Kramer, who's covered Russia and the oil and gas industries and business here for quite some time. And there are certainly people who take their money to Cyprus because they're looking to get it out of Russia. This may be money that they would prefer to have out of the country and off the books, so to speak. There are also people who go to Cyprus because they're looking for rule of law, as Andrew said, a country where you can put a contract in place and know that it will be adjudicated fairly in the courts, which some people don't trust here in Russia. And so you have both of those elements, both legitimate business and what we believe are some efforts at, whether if it's not quite money laundering, perhaps some tax evasion, keeping money offshore in some ways. So you have basically both ends of the spectrum in how Cyprus offers appeal. There's also, obviously, a whole different tax structure. So the ability to have money based in Cyprus that invest it around the world without paying capital gains is enormously appealing to some wealthy Russians.
So just tell me, how much has this taken people then by surprise in Russia? Because presumably, with that well-established relationship, the sums of money you mention are extremely significant. Do you think there'll be some feeling by the people who actually kind of are the end managers of this money that perhaps some of their underlings should have spotted this or alerted them or tried to kind of hedge their bets in some way?
Well, everyone knows with greater risk comes greater reward. And bank accounts in Cyprus have been paying quite good interest rates, 4%, 5%, even up to 7%. You and I both know what you get on your savings account if you have money in the bank in the UK or in the US, you know, not even 1% these days. So certainly people should have recognized there's some greater risk to be doing business in Cyprus, to have money in Cyprus. There's been talk of this kind of sacrifice being demanded of depositors in the context of the various bailouts that have been going on. But it's not clear that anyone took it seriously because of the drastic and risky message that it sends. What will the reaction be in Italy? What will the reaction be in Spain, where bank depositors may look at this and say, look, we could be next? Certainly, you hear it best from President Putin, who's calling it unfair, unprofessional, and dangerous. He doesn't come out and say those kinds of things all the time. This is clearly something that has raised alarm.
So tell me, David, let's kind of look ahead slightly. If this goes ahead as it's, as the plan, as it's currently set out documents, what happens? Where does this leave all these Russian investors? I mean, are people losing billions of pounds? What will be the end game here? Or will they resort to some kind of other action? What do you think is going to happen?
Well, it's very interesting. The question becomes, okay, where do you put your money? Would it be better in a savings account in the UK or the US? Would you make more interest there? Would it be safer in the stock market? The answer is probably not. So given the interest that has been paid on these accounts over the years, it may be that people look at this and say, you know what, this is actually not all that big a cost for doing business and having money in a place that's regarded as relatively safe with a decent legal system where there will be some return on investment. So it will be interesting to see if down the line people have actually a more favorable view of this than the instinctive response, which of course is whenever the government is threatening to take any of your money away. People are obviously very upset. For Cypriots themselves, one comparison would be to look at what their neighbors in Greece have gone through to get a similar kind of bailout from the European Union. Very, very painful austerity measures have been imposed. Obviously, the UK is no stranger to austerity measures. And if this is it, if this is the price that Cyprus pays in order to stabilize its economy, it may not be that big a price. It may not be that bad a deal.
That's really interesting. I just wondered, finally, David, there's some interesting sort of PR machines that were into effect. I know that Great Britain has said they'll, for example, credit members of the military who are serving in Cyprus who could stand to lose money. Are there any kind of PR games like that occurring in Moscow? Is that the kind of thing that would appeal to sort of a broader church, if you like?
We have not heard anything of that sort here. I think because the numbers would just be far too big. There's no way that the Russian government could fairly offer to cover this tax for one segment of the population and not for another. These are, in some cases, everyday depositors, in other cases, very big corporations. There's really just too much money at stake, I think. But I was covering Congress when we went through the bailouts and the financial crisis in 2008 in the United States. These situations are always fraught with very intense emotional debate over what is the, not the best course, but the least worst course of action to take as you try to stabilize an economy, you know, prevent millions of people potentially from losing jobs and losing even more. The alternative, of course, is the banking system in Cyprus collapses. Banks and people lose, you know, far more than this. So it's a very fraught emotional situation, understandably, and I think we will see people spinning it in all directions.
It's one we'll watch very closely. David Herznorn of the New York Times, thanks very much for joining us on Midori House today to unpick that issue from Moscow. Coming up next on the programme, members of Syria's opposition meet in Istanbul to choose an interim prime minister. But will they be able to agree on someone?
The beautifully turned out April issue of Monocle includes our new spring style directory, which takes a look at the best retail projects around the globe, the new shopping neighbourhoods, why Jakarta is on the fashion map, and how the Swiss make the watch world tick. We also take a visit to Tokyo Hands, the famous Japanese store where you can buy everything you didn't know you needed. And we have lots more in this issue too.
In the affairs section, we head to the Turkey-Syria border to discover what NATO is and isn't doing in Syria. We visit the largest Finnish community outside the Nordic region. It's in Canada. And we also meet a woman you might remember, Imelda Marcos, and her shoe collection.
In the business section, we take a sniff at the scent industry. We send our Paris correspondent south to Grasse to find out how the Provençal town is becoming a hub for high-tech innovation. And we introduce a new section, Master and Apprentice. In the first instalment, we profile a man who started tailoring aged 11.
In culture, we ask how you renovate and rebrand one of the world's greatest museums. We visit Amsterdam's Istanbul Rijksmuseum to see what a 10-year sabbatical teaches you. We also investigate high turnover tales in the world of the art postcard, and just for a minute, give in to the allure of the average, courtesy of our Culture Ed's column.
The April issue of Monocle is on newsstands now, or treat yourself to a subscription. Visit monocle.com now to find out how to join the club.
You're with Midori House on Monocle 24. To Turkey now, where key figures from Syria's opposition are meeting in Istanbul to discuss the future of the country and also, hopefully, elect an interim prime minister. Although there are currently no clear frontrunners, several leading opposition figures have emerged, including the former agriculture minister, Asad Mustafa, economist Osama Kadi, and Hassan Hito. The opposition coalition has said it won't try and operate a government via Skype and that the new prime minister and government would instead operate inside the country. Last week, of course, marked the two-year anniversary since the conflict began. So far, more than 70,000 people have been killed. Well, joining us to discuss who looks likely to win enough votes to be chosen as Prime Minister, and indeed what comes next, is Fawaz Jerjes, Director of the Middle East Centre at the London School of Economics. Fawaz, thanks as always for joining us on Midori House. I just wondered, have we learned anything today? Do we have any clearer idea about who might be put forward for this role?
No, I don't think so. I think the jury is still out. I think no one knows who's going to be elected. I still am not convinced yet that there will be an election tomorrow, given the divisions that exist within the Syrian National Coalition. Remember, this particular meeting is taking place against the wishes of the top leader of the Syrian National Coalition, Mr. Muaz al-Khatib. Mr. Muaz al-Khatib does not want to have a prime minister elected an interim government. He fears that the election of an interim government would deepen the divisions inside Syria, would create two competing governments, one in Damascus and one outside Damascus. But the reality is the dominant faction within the Syrian National Coalition wants to elect a government and a prime minister. Most probably Muaz al-Khatib would lose the fight tomorrow.
But it's interesting, though, isn't it, Fawaz? With that kind of dynamic there, I mean, how difficult is it going to be for anybody to establish, you know, any kind of legitimacy, however well managed their sort of candidacy campaign is and however much people who back them come out with the right kind of rhetoric? Is this going to be a question where this opposition group is just too fragmented for any single person to galvanize the kind of popular support they need?
Well, I think really you're putting your finger on the pulse of the challenge. The question is not really who's going to be elected, regardless. I don't think there are any major differences between the various candidates. The question is what kind of function, what kind of role, how effective such a government would be. would such a government operate inside Syria? We know that the opposition basically controls, a big chunk of territories in the north and the northeast. But the reality is it has not been able to establish real control, that the Syrian government has the capacity and the ability basically to bomb anywhere in Syria using its missiles and fighter jets and helicopters. And secondly, the question you're really asking goes to the very heart of the matter. Would a government elected by the opposition outside Syria be able to basically exercise control over the 100 or so armed factions inside Syria? I think there are major challenges, and that's one of the reasons why Mr. Muaz al-Khatib, the top leader of the Syrian National Coalition, is skeptical about establishing, electing a prime minister and interim government, because once, if this government fails to operate, fails to establish its legitimacy, the opposition outside Syria would be delegitimized further, its credibility undermined, and the Assad regime would say, well, look, the opposition is back at it again.
So tell me, Fawaz, what then is Muaz al-Khatib's strategy here? Is he trying to kind of chip away at the loyalist bloc there within Syria and maybe try and draw together a bit of a broader church of, you know, some former regime officials and members of the opposition? Is that his strategy? And is that the best strategy?
I think we know two things. We know first is that the election of Muaz al-Khatib was supposed to appeal to really merchant class in Damascus and Aleppo, because he comes from a, you might say, upper middle class family. And secondly, to appeal to the religious establishment, the moderate religious establishment. And what Muaz al-Khatib has been trying to do is to basically appeal, chip away at really the power base of the Assad regime. But the reality is Muaz al-Khatib does not have a power base within the opposition outside Syria. The reason is that the dominant faction within the opposition is basically wants to hold the elections tomorrow against the wishes of Muaz al-Khatib. Muaz al-Khatib has a minority allies within the coalition. And this, in fact, some of his own associates, called on him to resign because he basically refused to go along with the appointment of a prime minister and interim government. The reality is the power base within the Syrian National Coalition is what I call the militant, the so-called radicals who would like a rupture, who would like to, I mean, the election tomorrow of a prime minister and a government means that the option of war triumphs over the option of diplomacy and political solution. If a prime minister is elected tomorrow, if a government, interim government, is established, it means there is no return. This is basically a war to the bitter end, and the reality is, it seems to me, Muaz al-Khatib has already lost the debate to the more radical faction what we call the militant faction within the opposition.
Fawaz Jerjes, Director of the Middle East Centre at the London School of Economics. Thank you very much, as always, for joining us on Midori House.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Това е Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo. Dette er Monocle 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Tokyost, se on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo, Monocle 24 des.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Midori House live from Studio One here on Monocle 24. It's fast approaching Monday evening here in London, but on the East Coast, North America, our colleagues across the pond are just sitting down to lunch. So time, why better to check in with Monocle's Barrett Austin to see what's got people talking over there. Barrett, thank you for joining us on Midori House as always. Where are we getting started? I gather we're going to look at the Republican Party first up.
We are. Just today, just this morning, in fact, the Republican Party has introduced the Growth and Opportunity Project, which is essentially several months' worth of findings on the state of the Republican Party today. All of this came about after Mitt Romney was handed a blistering defeat in November. And what's come of this is a 98-page report pointing to all the reasons that Republicans are essentially out of touch in America today.
Oh dear, 98 pages. Does this make for grim reading? To what extent does it kind of recap a lot of the sort of diagnostics that were run after that heavy defeat?
It's pretty grim reading. I went through and sort of read through a number of the pages this morning, and I intend to go through and sort of figure out what's left, maybe later this afternoon if I can find any time. But what I was really shocked by is how honest the assessment was. It's been no surprise amongst anyone who watches American politics that the Republican Party is very much, its platform is completely out of line with most of American voters today. Its social values are very much seen as being derived from an aging demographic in this country, but if you look at what they talk about, it's essentially the point that, you know, the Republicans have lost 5 out of the past 6 elections in terms of the popular vote. So if the platform that the party is standing on today continues into the future, it's no doubt the party will essentially shrivel up and never win another federal election again.
So they've identified the problems. One could say that perhaps that wasn't too difficult a task. The more tricky thing, I imagine, is to actually figure out what to do about addressing them. What is there in this document that really reveals what the actual strategies will be to tackle some of these issues?
Well, first of all, if I could talk a little bit about some of the problems. Some of the issues that Mitt Romney in particular struggled with in November of this past year, one was the issue of the ground game. The fact that, you know, he really didn't do particularly well on states, the critical swing states. So I think focusing on making a stronger ground game effort is something that the party is really going to be working on. Beyond that, President Obama, over the past 2 election cycles, has essentially written the book on digital marketing and social media use. It's something that Republicans have failed at time and time and time again. So one of the things that the report calls for is creating an open source data unit that really focuses on bringing in potential voters and building up the social media capabilities amongst Republicans, because it's something that Democrats have time and time again really, you know, whipped Republicans on. Beyond that, the real issue is the fact that Republicans are seen to have a very weak message. It's something that's just not connecting with voters today. So I think that's something that, you know, is really going to be pushed for moving forward.
And tell me, Barrett, how are they going to do that? Because presumably you need to throw quite a lot of cash at that kind of, you know, to really change people's perceptions. That's going to require what? A lot of marketing budget, advertising, a real hit on that. Have they got the money as well as the desire to change that?
I think so. If you look at how much money was spent, particularly in engaging minority groups in this country, the Republican Party spent some $1 billion on its media buys this past election. Only 1% of that was focused on minority groups, television channels like Univision or BET, groups that focus Hispanics or African Americans in this country. So I think that, you know, inevitably the Republican Party has had something of a strong treasure chest in the past, but a lot of money is going to be spent on it. Right off the bat, they've called for a $10 million marketing campaign focused exclusively on targeting women, targeting Hispanics, targeting Asian Americans. I'm not entirely sure what this will entail, but I can assure you it will make for very interesting fodder amongst this country's liberal media pundits.
Now, you mentioned fodder there, Barrett. I've got to ask you about the Oscars for the American restaurant business. Tell us about these. I gather there's some big announcements today. Who's in the running?
So today, from Charleston, South Carolina, the James Beard Foundation announced the semifinalist for basically every single category for the James Beard Awards. The awards will be announced in May of this year. But yeah, as you say, I mean, the James Beard Awards are really, you know, they're sort of the defining honor for anyone who works in the food industry. The main thing that everybody was looking after this year is, you know, who are the top chefs and what are the top restaurants? And it seems, as far as restaurants go, it really scans across the country. Starting in San Francisco, you've got the Slanted Door, which is in the Ferry Building out there. Here in New York, Blue Hill Restaurant. In Chicago, there's an Italian restaurant called Spiaggia. And then going down into my own native Deep South, there's a restaurant in New Orleans called August, and one in my own native Alabama, a restaurant that's been there for about 25 years called Highlands Bar and Grill. And those are the ones that everyone's looking at this year, which will be, you know, one of these will be selected as America's top restaurant. And this, you know, the James Beard Foundation is something that everyone pays attention to. Whomever James Beard says is the best restaurant is America's best restaurant.
And what about from personal experience, Barrett? Have you? I just see you there, you know, kicking back at some of these restaurants. You presumably just tour around the nation, do you? Enjoying some fine dining?
Of course, I've been to all of these. No, in honesty, I've been to a couple of these. Just not too long ago, we were in San Francisco. Tyler and a handful of us were there this past year, and I had a chance to eat at the Slanted Door, which I was very impressed by. I've eaten at August, which is in New Orleans. It's run by a chef named John Besh, who owns maybe six or seven restaurants in Louisiana. And then Highlands Bar and Grill in Birmingham, Alabama, about an hour outside of Montgomery, where I grew up. It's a restaurant that I've had the chance of eating at a number of times. And I have to say that out of this list of six, this short list, I really hope that Highlands can win the top restaurant of the year.
It's making me very hungry already. Barrett Austin from our New York Bureau, thanks very much for joining me on Midori House. In the next half hour of the programme, we'll be heading over to Brazil to find out if Sao Paulo Fashion Week really matters. And we'll find out which architect has walked away with the industry's top prize.
It is, without a doubt, the highest accolade in the world of architecture. Really, everybody who is a household name in architecture has won it at some point.
Before all of that, though, let's get the latest news headlines from around the world.
Cyprus has been told it can vary the terms of a bank bailout after public protests and queues at cash machines. The €10 billion deal does come with one condition, though, a one-off levy on Cypriot bank accounts. Banks in Cyprus won't open until Thursday as politicians continue discussion. Russia's President Vladimir Putin has criticised the plans for the levy. At least 20 people are believed to have been killed in a series of explosions at a bus station in Nigeria. Several blasts were heard in the city of Kano in the north of the country. No groups yet admitted it was behind the attack, though the Islamist militant Boko Haram has attacked the city several times in the past. A man wanted over war crimes in the Democratic Republic of Congo has reportedly handed himself over at the US embassy in Kigali. Officials in Rwanda say Bosco Ntaganda surrendered to American authorities. He's accused of conscripting child soldiers, ethnic persecution and rape. Syria's main opposition groups have been meeting in Istanbul, discussing the formation of a provisional government. It would be on standby in case the Assad regime falls, but could also take over the running of rebel-held areas. And Airbus says it's delighted with a record order for 234 planes. The Indonesian carrier Lion Air is buying them. The deal's worth $24 billion. And those are the latest headlines on Monocle 24.
Vanuit Londen. Dit is Monocle 24.
Wei London. This is Monocle 24.
From London. This is Londres. Hollanda.
London. London, Europe, top.
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London.
London.
This is Monocle 24.
You're back with Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Tom Edwards, 1833 here in London. Now, after Milan, Paris, New York and London, guess which city takes the fifth spot in fashion? It's, of course, Sao Paulo, and today marks the first day of Sao Paulo Fashion Week. Brazil will be the first country in the world to showcase summer collections after a change in their calendar, which moved the event to March from its former home in January. Although the event proves that the domestic industry is very strong, some argue that Brazilian fashion sometimes doesn't travel well. And it's certainly true that there aren't that many renowned Brazilian fashion brands globally. Well, in a few moments, we'll be hearing from the Graça Cabral from Sao Paulo. Graça is the International Relations Director at Sao Paulo Fashion Week. But I'm delighted to say I'm also joined in the studio before that by our Brazilian researcher, Fernando Pacheco, who was at the event last year, if I understand correctly. So, Fernando, tell me a little bit more about the event and your impressions of it from being there last year. Does it really feel like Sao Paulo is punching sort of on its weight in the international fashion scene?
I do think so. I mean, I do have some critics about the event, which we're going to talk later, but I think Brazil's punching above its weight because, come on, it's the fifth largest fashion week in the world. I mean, of course, it's not like New York, London, Paris or Milan, but I think Brazil is doing very well. At least internally, we have a huge domestic market. And I think the question is, how can we export our brands? Because we do have some fashion brands well-known outside, but it's more... I mean, I can think of Havaianas. Can you think of another brand? I mean, we do have very talented designers, but I think it would be nice to see a more kind of international Brazilian brands around when you walk in London, New York, or and not only in Rio or São Paulo, you know what I mean?
And where do you think that the, if there is a small problem with maybe making that step onto the international stage, is it something the government should look at? Because it's a, it's potentially, well, it's already a big business. It's potentially an enormous one. Should the government, or could the government, be doing a bit more, do you think?
I think that's exactly, I would say the government should be doing more, because actually it's our second biggest industry. You know, for example, São Paulo Fashion Week is very well organized by Paulo Borges and by Graça as well, which we're going to talk in a while. So I think the government should really be investing that, because, I mean, it's our second industry and I don't see much investment. And there's another problem as well, Tom. You know, we have very high taxes in Brazil. And I mean, that's not only a problem with fashion, but of course it affects us. And so sometimes when you buy clothes in Brazil, it can be quite expensive. And now we have competition from foreign brands as well. But, you know, it's not all negative as well. I think Brazil is doing extremely well. And now the Fashion Week changed dates, and Graça will tell you a little bit more about that. So, yeah, but when I went to the event, it was quite nice to see that São Paulo is doing very well.
I'll ask you a little bit more about the event in a second. I just wondered, do you think there's also a bit of an issue within Brazil, because there are actually two fashion weeks? I mean, is Brazil spreading itself a bit too thin? Because it's not just São Paulo, of course.
Yeah. And it's funny to see, because São Paulo and Rio, they're both completely different cities in a way as well. So I was even going to suggest something, and I'm not sure what the other people think, but I think Rio would be great for spring, summer, and São Paulo for autumn, winter. So maybe, and then people can concentrate in only one fashion week instead of two. But that's just my thought, you know. I'm not, who am I to say that?
It's a good thought, Fernando. And I think if our listeners could see the high fashion value of your trousers today, for example, they would know you're a man to be listened to. Just tell me a little bit more about the event then, when you were there last year. What kind of things really struck you in terms of the dynamics that are there, the people who are showing work there?
Great organization, you know, and I saw Osklen, which is one of my favorite Brazilian brands. And what I like about Osklen, and maybe that's one thing that maybe Brazilian brands could expand abroad, is that they portray like a Brazilian way of life, you know. It's, how can I say, they sell a Brazilian lifestyle. Maybe that's what we should do more, you know, be proud of Brazilian. I know some people say, oh, Brazil is usually the cliché, sex, samba, sun, whatever. Let's explore that then.
It's not a bad set of clichés,
you know. Of course, we can add other things, but let's do more.
There's substance behind that. And I just wonder also, in terms of the next couple of years for Brazil, it's like a free marketing campaign of all that's great about the country. We've got the World Cup, the Olympic Games, so much focus. This is a really good opportunity, isn't it, for Brazil to sell some of these other businesses?
Exactly. And Tony, you know, I know a lot of countries love fashion, but Brazilians do love fashion. They love a little bit of color. They are very interested in it, you know. So it's a great industry for us to explore, you know, and to export, hopefully. Yeah, so...
Thanks, Fernando. Well, I think we've got now on the line Graça Cabral from São Paulo Fashion Week. Graça, thanks very much for joining us on the line. I just wanted to ask you, first of all, how important is São Paulo Fashion Week for the city and for Brazil? What kind of role does it serve there for the whole of the fashion business in Brazil?
Hello, thank you very much for talking with us. Well, São Paulo Fashion Week has established a calendar, a schedule for the whole of the chain of fashion in Brazil, and this happened 17 years ago. And we've always talked about São Paulo Fashion Week as a project of a 30-year project, a long-term project, which is very strange, sort of strange for Brazil, because we work on a very immediate basis here in our country. So it's very recent, this kind of thought of planning for a long term. And we're right in the middle of this project, and São Paulo Fashion Week has established, has positioned the country and the city of São Paulo as a place where you have creativity, where you have design, and where we have a whole week, twice a year, like the big fashion shows, fashion weeks around the world.
And Graça, just tell me about the change in dates of the event. How important is that? And do you think that will change the kind of themes that we might see during Fashion Week?
You're talking about the new date?
That's right, yeah.
I'm sorry. Yes, yes. Well, we've been discussing this for a long time already. As you might know, we used to launch winter in January and summer collections in May, June, And what happened was that we had a very short time of between production and launching and actually delivering these products in the city, in the stores. So now we are trying to establish a good calendar for everybody, for the producer, for the buyers, and also for the final retail, so that they can have more time between the production and the launching and the delivering. I think this is going to help a lot with the planning and also with the results that they will have. Because we used to have a lot of things that were canceled because of the designers and the companies couldn't deliver all that they had sold. So I think this is going to bring a new perspective for all of them.
Graça Cabral from São Paulo Fashion Week, thanks very much for joining us on Midori House. Fernando Pacheco is still with me. Encouraging signs from Graça there, Fernando. Do you think that we'll see more Brazilian bands going global after this?
I think we will, so excellent. I'm very positive about it.
That's
but, we have to, please, government, help the fashion industry. We do that so well. We need help.
I'm sure they'll heed your warning, Fernando. Now, I gather you're going to give us a little bit of music to get us in the Sao Paulo flavor.
Exactly, and the vocalist is Brazilian top model Janine Marques, and the song is Little Joy, and the band is Top Play Moon.
That was Stop Play Moon with Little Joy. You're listening to Midori House. We'll be back right after this with a look at whether one desert town in Israel can transform itself into an urban oasis.
Section D is the show you listen to for the untold stories, secrets and blazing headlines in the design sphere. The architects, fashion followers, artists and engineers who are making and breaking the trends across the world.
When Valentino touches the clothes, you see his hands tracing those lines of shape, form, and to see Valentino arranging one of his dresses is to understand the dress in terms of structure.
Join me, Hugo MacDonald, for an hour of insight, interviews, and discussion every Tuesday at 1900 hours London time.
That's Section D with Hugo MacDonald, premiering every Tuesday at 1900 hours UK time, right here on Monocle 24.
You're listening to Midori House. The time is just approaching 18:45 here in London. Now, Israel is a tiny country. Most of its population of 7 million is squeezed into the centre, and the West Bank settlements on Palestinian land are a controversial area of expansion. Developing the Negev Desert in Israel's south is seen as a project of national significance. In the April issue of Monocle, Daniela Pellid visits the Negev's capital, Be'er Sheva, where a dynamic young mayor is hoping to transform this desert town of 200,000 into an urban oasis. He faces not only a major image problem, but also allegations that the renewal project ignores the need of the area's Arab population.
Outside Be'er Sheva City Hall, an avenue of fountains gently splashes. There are dozens of these rainbow-lit water features springing up all over town, as well as a 1,300-acre riverside project and even a city beach. It's all part of a massive rebranding initiative to make this into Israel's water city, a place where life is good and everything is possible. The only problem is, that's not how Israelis see it.
If you're going to tell someone, what do you think about Be'er Sheva? In Israel, in Tel Aviv, in Jerusalem, he has some visions in his mind, visions about desert and very old and dusty buildings.
Amos Shavit is head of brand and marketing at the Be'er Sheva municipality. He's part of a team which hopes that a 10-year, 3 billion shekel regeneration plan will transform the city's fortunes from a remote, dilapidated, economically neglected place to a flagship of urban renewal.
I'm here to change those visions, to tell a new story about tourism, high-tech technology, about art, culture and music and youth and fun and parks and water and trees, a place that you want to live, to raise kids and to hang around.
This is a project of national significance. The centre of the country is incredibly crowded, the settlements of the occupied West Bank politically loaded. But the Negev Desert, which makes up more than half of Israel's total landmass, is currently home to just 8% of its population. This makes its capital, Be'er Sheva, according to Ruvik Danilovich, its charismatic young mayor, a city of opportunities. These opportunities, he says, include tourism. An 18 million shekel project will celebrate Be'er Sheva as the home of the biblical patriarch Abraham, and business with a new high-tech park currently being built. As for remote, well, a revamped train line means it's already just 45 minutes to Tel Aviv. At the Negev Museum of Art, in the Turkish governor's former mansion, the latest exhibit is being unpacked from its bubble wrap, a series of prints by iconic Israeli photographer Micha Ba'am.
One friend told me some time ago that the distance between Be'er Sheva and Tel Aviv is not the same as the distance from Tel Aviv to Be'er Sheva. And he's quite right.
Dalia Manor is the director of the museum and wants to see Be'er Sheva become a hub of art and culture.
We just have Sigalit Landau, who is, I think, one of the most famous artists in Israel at the present. She shows internationally at the very moment. We had the honor to show, to be the first to show a big sculpture of hers. It's called Shelter. And you know what? Lots of people ask, how did you manage to get her coming to the Negev? And they also ask her, why did you come to the Negev? And, you know, she said the very obvious thing when she was asked, I was invited.
This response, says Manor, speaks volumes about what people think of Be'er Sheva.
That it's a marginal, peripheral, little, unimportant place, I assume. You know, I read the subtext of these questions. Journalists were here. They were quite impressed, but they still ask the question. Aren't the people in the Negev entitled to get, you know, good art? Are they only have to go to Tel Aviv or to Jerusalem or to anywhere? And why not people from the other parts of Israel should not come here to see art that we show here?
The Negev is also home to some 200,000 Bedouin Arabs, half of whom live in unrecognized villages. Israel is keen for the area to retain its Jewish majority, but the Bedouins say that they too are citizens and should benefit from investment.
My name is Ra'ed Al-Makawi. I'm the director of Bustan, an organization that works in the Bedouin community. We're sharing the same area, like the same facilities, the same governmental offices, and people are ignorant about each other, and that's a huge gap to narrow.
The Bedouin, he says, are to a large extent invisible, transparent in the eyes of those redeveloping the city.
There could be some sort of collaboration that interacts these residents, like the transparent residents, with the permanent ones to create a better understanding between communities.
Some argue that the authorities should work on the needs of those already here before attracting newcomers. For now, the focus for Be'er Sheva seems to be on gentrification and high-end jobs, and those rainbow-coloured fountains. From Be'er Sheva, for Monocore, I'm Daniela Pellet.
And you can read about plenty more international affairs and culture stories in the April issue of Monocle, which is on its way to our subscribers and on newsstands this week. It's one of the most prestigious awards in the world of architecture, and this year the Pritzker Prize has gone to Toyo Ito. The Japanese architect with more than 40 years' experience has been congratulated for his timeless buildings and improving the quality of both public and private spaces. Before the show, I spoke to Monocle's design editor, Hugo MacDonald, to ask him a little more about the prize and the winner.
The Pritzker Prize was founded by the Pritzkers, really as an answer to the fact that architecture wasn't recognised by the Nobel Prizes. And it is, without doubt, the highest accolade in the world of architecture. Really, everybody who is a household name in architecture has won it at some point or will win it eventually this year is Toyo Ito, the Japanese architect. Some would say it's been a long time coming for him, but others would say that it's a signal of the way the architecture industry is going at the moment. Toyo Ito is a very humble architect at the top of his game. He's not comparable to Zaha Hadid or Rem Koolhaas or any of the architects who plonk buildings in the middle of cities, really, that are a signature of their legacy. He's someone that puts much more sort of care and thought into how buildings respond to their environment or respond to the sort of social need of wherever he's building for, whoever he's building for.
So how political then is the process each year, and how, to what extent do you think that this year's committee were aware of that, aware of perhaps some of the criticisms of some of these, I suppose you could call them grandstanders, and how much do you think it is a political recognition as much as for his impressive oeuvre of work?
It's interesting that Toyo Ito and his team won the Golden Lion at the last Venice Architecture Biennale for his fantastic project called A Home for All, which was a response, and a very small but very significant response, to the devastation following the earthquake and tsunami in Tohoku region in Japan 2 years ago. That was in Rikuzen Takata, which completed last year, and he took an exhibition showing exactly what he'd done to the area, to Venice, and unanimously won over all the judges for the Golden Lions. And I think the fact that he's now been awarded the Pritzker Prize, it's no sort of accident or coincidence that it comes off the back of that. Lord Palumbo, who's the chairman of the prize, spoke about how Toyo Ito has an impressive body of work stretching 40 years, combining conceptual innovation with superbly executed buildings. He doesn't say that really it's his amazing social housing that is the reason he's won it, but I think that the fact he's been awarded the Pritzker now is a recognition that people are a bit bored of these monuments popping up in cities, that really they're impressive buildings, but they don't really give anything or forward architecture in any way. They're more like statues or sculptures.
So talk to me a bit about this. Is he then one of these kind of architects? Is that a slightly, I mean, it's a cliche evidently, but is that helpful, do you think? Is there a real sense within the world of architecture that you do have these people who are superstars? As you said, they're almost artists rather than architects. Is there any reticence about that from some of the other players who consider themselves more career oriented? As you said, they're interested in how their buildings work into the social fabric. Is there a division, or do you think that, like all of these kind of creative industries, it needs a bit of both to work?
No, well, you're right there. The division between this, if, I mean, people refer to them as star architects, which is a term that I hate.
That is unpleasant.
I know, and architects who really do good and are not interested in putting their own names on the buildings, but actually forwarding how architecture can improve quality of life, be it in cities or countryside, wherever. That division is polarising, definitely. And going back to the Venice Architecture Biennale again last summer, this sort of division is more stark than ever, because suddenly, as much as people with a lot of money who want to commission Zaha Hadid to build an opera house in their city, they're doing that because they want to put their own name and they want to tick the box of having this world-renowned architect building something in their city. People who commission the likes of Toyo Ito do it because they know that they're going to get a fantastic, well-thought-out, well-executed project that benefits the people who live there or the people who work in that building. So for me, the fact that he's been awarded the Pritzker Prize is a signal of big change in the industry in terms of what the values are from the people at the top.
So does he then have any kind of marquee projects? Are there any particular things that were cited by the committee or from your own sort of frame of reference
that
you particularly like about him?
The Pritzker Prize is a way of opening up the architecture industry to the rest of the world. And architecture is quite a closed industry that doesn't necessarily get a huge amount of recognition from sort of everyday Joe public. But most people have heard of the Pritzker Prize. And so it's sort of welcoming someone into that hall of fame. And by way of doing that, they always pinpoint the most recognisable projects that the architect has built. So this year, everybody's saying, oh, the Todds Omotesando building in Tokyo and the Sendai Media Tech, which are two of Toyo Ito's slightly louder, more recognisable buildings. And it's a shame that they pinpoint those rather than the amazing House for All project that he did. I suppose it's just that people can pin him to something that they might have seen pictures of and think, oh yes, so he's the biggest architect in the world at the moment.
And just briefly on this, we've obviously seen, you know, Frank Gehry, Renzo Piano, a lot of the big names have won this prize. Are there any perennial non-winners? Is there anyone who people say, well, surely the time is right? Anyone even this year people said, oh, it must surely be time for this great illustrious figure to be recognised?
It's a difficult question. Zaha Hadid, when she won a few years ago, everybody was like, oh my goodness, I can't believe that she hasn't won it before. In terms of people waiting in the wings, I suppose Big in Copenhagen, which is fantastic, very conceptual, but very fun and playful. And also they don't manage to sort of exclude social projects or sort of very good architecture in their work. I would think that maybe they might be recipients in a year or two. They possibly might be a little bit disappointed today not to be the winners, but they're very young. And the other thing about Toyo Ito is he's been working for 40 years. It's sort of a bit of a pat on the back for a very good career, which is by no means over. So no surprises here at all.
Good stuff. So Toyo Ito gets the $100,000, and you seem generally fairly happy about that.
Well done, Toyo Ito. I am indeed.
That was Monocle's design editor, Hugo MacDonald, sharing his enthusiasm for Toyo Ito's success in the Pritzker Prize today with me a little earlier.
Vanuit London, dit is Monocle 24.
Wei yu London, zhe shi Monocle 24.
From London, wei zai Londres.
Orlando,
London, Europa,
Hong Kong,
Zurich,
London.
This is Monocle 24.
I'm afraid that's all we have time for on today's episode of Midori House. My thanks to our producer, Phil Hahn, our researcher, Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Edward Lucas, and our studio manager, Chris Fitch. Next up is Culture, where Rob Bound will be chatting to Brett Anderson, lead singer of Suede, and also to Alan Smolinski, a man from LA who loved his local paper so much that he bought it.
And I just love feeling the paper in my hand. I love going in the driveway and grabbing all the different papers and sorting them with my OCD and picking them up and reading them in the same exact order every day of my life.
It's a terrific interview on Culture. Do stay tuned on Monocle 24. In 3 hours' time, at 2200 hours here in London, Emma Nelson and Andrew Muller will be back for the Monocle Daily. And Andrew Tuck, our editor, will be back with Midori House at the very same time tomorrow. Until then, thanks for listening.
A Rolex timepiece represents an ongoing commitment to innovation, horological expertise, and the passion of skilled watchmakers. All add up to make the one principle by which Rolex lives: that greatness is a journey that never ends. Rolex.